Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 279 for comics originally released on December 12th, 2012. Now, starting us off in DC is Batgirl number 15. This is part of the Death of the Family storyline, or the arc, or event, or crossover, whatever marketing tag you want to give that. And this is, like, the second part of this story for this title that started last time. Yeah, second part. I had some really, I want to say mixed feelings, but frankly, I think they were more negative feelings towards this issue than positive. This thing just hit a lot of kind of the wrong buttons with me. And I mean, it's not a horrible issue, but man, it just, it was, I think, targeted to an audience that likes very different things than me. I don't know about you, Bob, but I am not liking this gross kind of look for the Joker with the whole face ripped off. And
I agree with you on that. And I've heard both directions. I mean, some people really like the creepy, horrific aspect of this, but this look for the Joker with the kind of face tied on with, I don't know, pieces of string and leather straps or something. It does not look good to me. I always thought that the Joker, when done right, was a sufficiently creepy looking villain. You know, different artists, you know, have all had different interpretations of the Joker, and he can look creepy enough. To some extent, it just looks stupid to me with the face tied on, but and that's just a personal opinion, of course. And some people, I mean, different people are going to react to these things, you know, their own ways. And anyone who looks at it and says, "Wow, that's really cool. It's the best I've ever seen the Joker look." Well, I mean, that's their personal reaction to it. And that's valid, but not for me. I'm with you on that one. Now, I didn't read the first part of this. This was one of the two issues. The first issue of Catwoman in this arc also that kind of crept up and flew off of store shelves to the point where those comics are like still going on the aftermarket for like 10, 15 bucks a pop. And in reading this stuff, it's like, well, I'm not going to pay that kind of money for getting that book. But, you know, I suspect that 10 years from now, those will not retain that kind of value.
I don't even think it'll take 10 years for that, but I know what you mean.
It's a, you know, Daredevil's armor kind of increase in value.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, first appearance of, you know, whatever, Deadpool or something.
I mean, this time next year, I would expect the back issue prices on these issues that have sold pretty quickly or whatever to cool off and be very affordable and not as high above the other stuff. I could be wrong on that, but it usually doesn't take all that long.
Now, one thing I will say about this, it's a general comment that I think might tail into your thoughts on this issue, is I didn't think it was a bad issue, but I really lament the fact that there used to be a lot of comics that you could buy and give to a kid to read.
Yes, I was going to comment on the "this is a teen."
I would never give this comic book to a little kid. It's very violent. It's very creepy, and that's valid. But it's not. It's taking these DCU books, and you know, so many of them are becoming increasingly violent and.
Well, and gory, yeah. And stuff. This is the kind of book that if I had read this when I was, you know, 14, and you know, earlier in my comic book reading experience, much younger and stuff, this particular issue would have turned me off on the Joker entirely, quite possibly Batgirl, and, well, actually the whole Death of the Family thing probably would have had me permanently back out of the whole Batman quadrant of the universe. from there it would not have been a huge leap to just not read DC. At that point for me, with some of the stuff I was going through with the surgery on my arm and some stuff like this, that would have hit the same wrong buttons it did now, but at a much worse time for me to deal with that. The whole, the stuff they did to Barbara's mom and stuff with the finger and stuff, it's just, it doesn't need this level of gore, grossness, and I think the Joker works better without that level of gore, where he's just a complete mind game kind of a character.
Which they have in the flashback scene in this very issue.
But and I thought that was
perfectly...
It was really well done, but it was undercut by the present day stuff.
No, I understand, but I'm saying you can see from that sequence that he can be a very creepy, effective bad guy without having the, you know, face tied onto him, you know, kind of a thing.
Well, speaking of C from that sequence, that brings up one of the other things I wanted to mention. Go to the double page spread at the beginning. They're in this roller skate park or whatever, and the Joker's kind of, you know, skating around. We see Barbara, we see her mother, and in the background we see, you know, three or four people. We never see those people again until about 11 pages later when it actually matters to the story. Batgirl's like, well, I can't leave these people. And I'm like, what people? Oh, these people. And I had to go flip back to this to go, oh, they were there. I mean, to me, this goes towards the artist having done the establishing shot, but then for so long between cutting to different scenes and coming back and whatever, never reasserting those people being there, that story point, you know, 11 pages later just almost seemed like a non sequitur out of the blue or whatever. So there are a few places in the issue itself where I think this goes back to art direction, editorial input, and coaching of writers and artists that just doesn't happen these days, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it seems like even more than half of the panels are completely devoid of any kind of a background. I mean, they're just like kind of a splash of color or a lens flare, some, you know, things like that. But there is not a lot of proper use of backgrounds for establishing the action. It's just all on the foreground characters.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that's not catastrophic to it, but it did weaken that part of the story for me, you know. And the other thing that really undercut this story for me was the fact that we've got the death of the family going on. This could have been a very, and should be, and kind of is, a very personal story between Barbara and the Joker, who maimed her and left her in a wheelchair for years. And the fact that he's showing up in every other Batman family title kind of depersonalizes this story, because he's currently going and mucking with all the other characters at the same time. Now, for a couple of them, they have similar personal-type stories they could do, you know, with Red Hood and stuff like that. But doing them all simultaneously, I think, cheapens and undercuts the impact of all of those. You know, if it's a matter that the Joker had been out there for a while, and then over the course of a year, he would just, out of the blue, come into an issue of, you know, one of the titles, make some major kind of splash, really impact the character, and then poof, he's gone for a little bit. Where will he show up next? That could have been a lot of fun. But I'm having mixed feelings on the whole death of the family, you know, just in general. Some of it's good, some of it's okay. The whole take on the Joker right now, again, not working with me. And this is not a horrible issue, but again, it hit a lot of the wrong buttons for me. It, again, didn't benefit from the fact that the Joker's showing up in all these other titles. To me, this was an average issue. And frankly, not one that I would ever recommend to somebody, but just because, you know, I personally found it distasteful in places.
I mean, I read it. I was able to Gail Simone's credit as a writer, I have not been reading Batgirl. I mean, I've been reading Batman, you know, so of the death of the family stuff, I get on the Batman family right now, pretty much just Batman and Detective. And the layman issues of Detective have not been tied into this death of the family yet, if they are going to be. I did pick up that issue of Suicide Squad we talked about. So I've read a couple of the issues in this, whatever it is, event, you know. But
epic
not
event,
all.
According to epic, the postcard. You know,
but to her credit, I picked up this issue kind of out of the blue without having read the previous issue of this title or the majority of the other issues of the Death of the Family crossover, and without any kind of a what has gone before page or anything, I felt like I threw the action in the story and how she told the story, I pretty much understood, I think, exactly what was going on here.
I agree. I think the accessibility rating for the story was surprisingly high for a modern comic. Everything that you needed to know to understand kind of how what had happened before that was relevant to this issue was in this issue and given pretty much at the right places at the right times. To understand, okay, what happened to Mom? What's going on with Joker? Why does Batgirl care? What's going on with the brother? You know, the roommate even was kind of properly, you know, established and stuff. And very subtly done, not with great, you know, expository captions or dialogues with, you know, this is who this is and an arrow pointing to somebody or something.
So in that respect, I mean, again, Simone's writing a story. She's, you know, playing the hand she was dealt here. I mean, she didn't rip off the Joker's face and tie it on with string. That was done by someone else, and it's a DC thing. So she's got to deal with that, right? The actual crafting of this story was way above the bar from a lot of the superhero comics that I read nowadays, where I will pick up an issue if I've not been reading that series, and it's like, what the heck is going on here? And it's not that particularly accessible. And this, I got to give her tremendously high marks on just the storytelling craft that went into this issue. Now, I don't like some of the story choices and, you know, things like that, but the actual craft that went behind it was done at an extremely high level.
I can see that, particularly the points about the accessibility. That's a very valid point and something I think a lot of other writers could learn from. So what rating would you give it?
I'm going to, because of the storytelling craft angle and the fact that it was accessible, I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I'm going to notch it up for that.
I can see that.
I think that deserves some mention. I mean, in general, it was a 3 out of 5 issue for me that gets knocked up because of the exceptional craft of storytelling here.
Well, and again, the fact that you hadn't been reading the book and you could follow along and fully understand it, that is worth a lot.
I give it a lot of credit because there are a lot of books lately that I've been picking up since I've been cutting back that I pick up an issue that I haven't been read, and I don't feel that same way. And if every writer could kind of grasp that skill, it would make comics a lot better. Because when people pick up an issue, they can, even first issues, a lot of times,
yeah,
they're not as accessible as this number 15 issue was. So how was your rating?
I gave it 3.
3, okay.
I did that a few minutes ago.
Yep. I was in my own head there.
I wasn't going to say that. Shall we move on to the Marvel book?
The Avengers Arena Murder World with the Battle Royale homage cover. Now, this one, I will say, I give Dennis Hopeless a tremendous amount. I will give him similar kudos on, you know, from the solicit of this down to the way that the cover looks. You know, my first impression of this book was, okay, he's doing a Battle Royale ripoff, or he's doing a Hunger Games riff or something like that. And even in the story, they make reference to those kind of things. And, you know, there are even some stylistic elements here that are like that. But to his credit, as I'm actually reading the book, it did not appear to me to be any kind of a riff on, you know, any kind of a direct riff or ripoff or homage or whatever you want to call it to either Battle Royale or Hunger Games. What to me it appeared to be was, you know, what if Arcade's Murder World actually had murder in it? You know, it was like the guy's been around for a really long time. He builds these really elaborate, you know, things, and he never seems to kill anybody. And the whole point of this series seems to be, okay, now I built another murder world, and I'm going to get all these kid characters in it, I'm going to kill them all off, or I'm going to kill a bunch of them off. And that's, you know, that said, not a big fan of that particular high concept.
Yeah, so. I can see that. To me, I mean, the series doesn't win any real points for originality. I mean, we've seen the basic concept of, you know, getting a bunch of people together, have them go fight sort of a deal before. I mean, not just in, you know, places like a Battle Royale and Hunger Games kind of a deal, but I mean, we've seen it before in Marvel Comics. To a certain degree, this is the deadly teen angst version of Secret Wars. I mean, it's got some differences, but let's go grab a bunch of these characters, put them in a confined environment and say, you know, go have a slugfest and kill people. Which, you know, hey, there's a time and a place for that. The fact that this started at day 29 and then rewound to day 1 in pretty short order, I rarely like that storytelling technique. You know, it let them start with a big action sequence and then kind of build to it, but... You know, we're not going to get back to day 29 until the end of this. This is what, 5 issues?
I think it's an on. Well, I haven't seen it being. Oh. I think it's an ongoing so far.
Wow. But that, you know, based on the solicitation, you're right. It's not listed as a one of.
They'll have 5 issues out by January 30th or something
probably,
at this rate. The second issue's already out.
Yeah, it came out on the 19th, so a week after this. That's crazy.
At the pace that they're moving. I can easily see it taking them 25 or 30 issues to kill all the characters they're planning to kill here. You know, if they in fact do continue killing, characters.
I've got a theory on this. Given the way this issue ended and kind of what they've done here, I'm wondering if this is a virtual world, which would give them the easy out to unkill characters.
Yeah, that's a very interesting. I hadn't thought of that. That would, if I was reading this series and I got 25 issues in and then it was like, oh, Bobby woke up in the shower, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
It was like, none of that happened. It was like, I would be kind of irritated, but you know, as it is, I do not anticipate continuing on with this series. So, you know, that's neither here nor there for me.
Well, I'll let you know, cause I'll keep going with it. But I thought, the sacrificial lamb in this issue was one that they had spent too much time in other titles, you know, establishing and building up as a character, that to, you know, off him the character got a good killing, but it seemed like a waste.
One of the handful of characters that I actually knew who he was and liked, you know, it's like he's killed in the first issue.
And it gets me to where I can't buy that he's dead. Or
I don't
stay
know.
Dead.
I don't know who half the people in this thing are. And
there are a couple that are new, but yeah.
You know, it's just it's a very large cast, so I can't really tap hopeless on that one. But, you know, it didn't feel to me like the Batgirl issue. You know, again, it was like I'm reading this issue and it's a number one and it felt far less accessible to me than that Batgirl issue felt.
Well, this one also had to resort to the huge monitor screen where he's got the 16 characters and needs, you know, insets to name all of them. Just so, oh, that's who they all are. And some of them we rarely see clearly.
I'm not sure, you know, I mean, I know who the ones are from Avengers Academy because I was reading Avengers Academy.
Probably know the ones from Runaways.
I know the ones from Runaways, the Kid Britain and the ones from the Excalibur Academy. I don't know who really they are.
I think they're new.
Okay. Basically, on the big screen, I mean, I know who Reptile and Nico, Minoru, and Darkhawk obviously are. I know who Hazmat and Metal are, X-23, and Chase. And that's it. So Apex.
Wasn't Justin with the Runaways?
If he was, I don't remember. Maybe is he the one who was the Ultron one?
That son of Ultron or some such.
Okay.
I thought.
Maybe.
One of the later editions.
Okay.
But Bloodstone, Anachronism, Nara, Kid Britain, and Red Raven, I believe, are all new characters. But I could be wrong on that.
Who is Cammy?
Cammy. That may be another one that's new. Not ringing any bells. Yeah. Part of it is some of these are frankly forgettable characters if they have shown up.
So, I mean, there's the one who is like a Deathlok riff, and I think they're going to give issues, you know, they're going to spotlight these characters.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so you'll learn over time who they are.
Now, one question I had for you is Arcade. I mean, I've read a lot of stuff with him before, but this version of Arcade, he's changed a lot since the last time we saw him.
Oh, very, very different look for Arcade, and I think people are going to like this look or not. I think that they changed him to make him more menacing and accessible to the target audience for this book.
Well, he's younger, he's quote-unquote hipper, seems a lot more powerful, and a much better fighter than we've ever seen him before.
But I think the power level, the power he's exhibiting would play into the theory that you espoused, which is, you know, if his interaction with these guys is in a virtual reality world, then, you know, he could make himself look younger and cooler and have all these powers, you know, as his avatar in that world.
Yeah. It explains a lot of things that are otherwise a little inexplicable. And it would also give him the ability to restart the game whenever he wanted to. So it's going to be interesting to see if they go that way or if they are indeed trying to kill some of these characters. It just doesn't make sense to me that they would do that for some of them.
Yeah, it also explains how you would have, you know, like snow in one part and, you know, all these different environments and stuff.
Well, and at one point he says, I'm not the villain here, I'm the god. Yeah. And again, that plays into, I mean, he's done very impressive murder worlds before, but this just seems to be up a level from everything else. And overall, I enjoyed this issue, but I'm having a hard time buying into they're actually going to permanently kill off any of these characters. Even if that's truly their intent, at some point there's going to be a change in the administration, if you will, at Marvel, and they'll say, you know, let's bring back the Runaways, and they're in here, half of them are in here, and if they die, well, that's going to be hard, so they're going to undo that. I mean, a couple of these characters, yeah, they can and probably should kill off, but a couple of the others, no, they spent too much time and done, frankly, some good work establishing that it would be a real waste if they did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did pick up the second issue and read it because, you know, I'm buying this off the rack, and I'm not going to go into detail on it. But
please don't. I've got it sitting here but have not looked at it yet.
I will just suffice to say, I mean, like this issue, I thought it was a well-done issue, but the story concept is not something that I want to read on an ongoing basis.
I can see that, because with this first issue, I thought it was fine. It was entertaining. Nothing that really made me think, wow, this is some great characterization, or some great dialogue, or some great plot points, or some really innovative concepts, or something that really kind of bumped it up in any particular area. To me, it was perfectly fine, but average issue.
Yeah, and, you know, the only thing I will say is that it does establish that, you know, they're going to have focus and more depth on some of the individual characters on an ongoing basis. So,
I thought that was pretty clear from this first issue, because they were the two characters they really focused on. I don't want to reveal who, since that might give people a clue as to who got bumped off. But, I mean, and there was some good stuff with those two characters, but the rest were placeholders. So the fact that they're going to rotate through and eventually we'll get to them all right as they die, you know, gives me mixed feelings.
Yeah.
So 3 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, I'm in about the same place. It's not something that I'm gonna pick up, but not a bad issue, but just not something that resonated with me.
Cool.
Now, our indie book this week is The Hollows, #1, by Chris Ryall and Sam Keith. Chris Ryall is the chief creative officer, editor-in-chief over at IDW, and he's writing this one along with Sam Keith, who what would people know Sam Keith from? He did The Max. You know, that's his main thing, and he's done he's done arcs on Batman at DC and, you know, lots of other characters. He's got a very unique style. he's the kind of a guy, and we've talked about this before, but you know, it's like when you look at Sam Keith art, it's like, okay, that's Sam Keith art. He's got a very distinctive style. Sometimes that's going to assert itself to the detriment over the type of story, especially when it's telling a story in an established superhero universe to me. But, you know, on a creator-owned thing like this, it just serves to give it that very unique kind of feel. And he did some pretty cool things in this issue. At least they worked for me with, you know, just the way he's drawing the images, and he'll, in the art, kind of put in these little labels with an arrow, kind of a comment, you know. So the hollows, right? I feel like I want to give kind of an overview of this. So it's a kind of post-apocalyptic future kind of thing. It's set in Japan. They have these giant engineered trees. I don't know how to say it. It's like they have these giant trees. I mean, giant, you know, like miles high. And they've got the futuristic city kind of built up in the tree. And then down in the on the ground, they've got the hollows, which are these kind of lost soul kind of zombie-ish kind of characters, but they feed on the souls of the living. And you have the society that lives up in the tree, and they're, to some extent, you know, the hollows are kind of like these ghosty, you know, kind of characters. And you have the futuristic society up in the tree, and one of the guys from the tree ends up down below, and he meets a group of people down there and interacts with them. You see the hollows, you see some of these characters, and the story progresses from there. I don't want to ruin anything there, but Keith's art style, for me, really complemented this story. It helped add a certain amount of richness to it, and it worked really well for me. Now, that's going to, you know, this is a big your mileage may vary kind of a thing, because I can see someone picking this book up and it's like, man, this is just not for me. But I really enjoyed it. This is something that I'm definitely going to be keeping on an ongoing basis. And I just loved seeing Sam Keith's art in this issue, because it's been a long time since I've seen Sam Keith's art. And I think the good thing about this is you can go to a comic shop, you can kind of pick this book up and flip through it, and if this art really strikes you, then you think, wow, that's really cool, then you're a great candidate for liking this book. And if you pick it up and flip through it and it's like, oh, I don't really like that, you know, it's like, you know, you probably shouldn't read it. And it's one of those kind of ones where I think as a consumer, doing the flip-through test in the comic shop is going to be very helpful on guiding whether you will enjoy reading the series or not. So, you know, for me, big thumbs up. I mean, I can't quite give it a 5 out of 5, because there's a lot of questions left unanswered. But he did establish, you know, quite a lot in this first issue. But for me, it was a strong 4 out of 5. And I'm definitely going to be ongoing reading this issue, and I look forward to how they develop these characters and develop this world over the next however many issues this runs.
Cool. I passed on it. I'm just not a fan of Keith's art style. Nothing wrong with it. It's just, you know, isn't something that I tend to go for. So
yeah. I mean, to me, it was the solicits, you know. It's like when I saw Sam Keith's doing a new thing, it was my thing was like, ooh, cool, I haven't seen Sam Keith in a long time, and I love his art. And you know, you were like, well, I don't really like Sam Keith's art, and that helped you make that decision. Yeah. I would add that, you know, the actual storyline with the kind of soul-sucking ghosts and this kind of stuff probably not be that much up your alley either, so...
That was kind of what I was thinking, you know, the devouring of souls and stuff like that. It's like, I know there's going to be an audience for that, and that's great. I'm just not part of that, which is fine.
But I definitely would recommend that people give this one a look in the shop and make a determination on it. So, big thumbs up for me. I highly recommend giving this one a look.
Cool.
Now, I read the other, I don't know if there were more than one. I did read Cable and X-Force.
I read that one.
I will give Dennis Hopeless credit on that one because he wrote that one in addition to Avengers Arena. I found that number one issue, even though it was an X-Men kind of a book, I felt that it was very accessible to me. I did not, a lot of times I'll read an X-Men-ish first issue and I come away from it kind of scratching my head, not knowing who most of the characters are and what most of the references are. And I felt that that one was, there was a very strong clarity of writing in it. And I really enjoyed the first issue there. That one, I wish that was a $2.99 book instead of Avengers Arena. It's the price point on that one's a little bit of a barrier for me with the frequency of it.
I was also going to say it includes that free digital copy. That's why it's the buck extra, or that's why they're trying to justify it that way. But the advantage to that one has is, I mean, Forge, Domino, Colossus, and Cable, you should have already known who they are. So Dr. Nemesis would have been the only real character you might not have been that familiar with.
And I'm aware of him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, like, familiar with him, but I kind of know who he is and what his deal is, just from around.
I'm wondering if there's going to get to a point where either Cable and X-Force and the new Thunderbolts kind of cross over or whatever, or if there's just some market confusion between the two. Because they've got a similar kind of a feel or a vibe to them, if you know what I mean. Almost a monochromatic look to the team. Black, white, and some red. They're the Strike Force kind of a team, you know. I don't know. It just, I think they may blur together in some people's minds. I read a couple of things I want to comment on real quickly. Fantastic Four number 2, decent issue. Aspects of it had me thinking it should have been FF number 2, though. So I'm wondering if Fraction's going to be kind of blurring the line between those titles a little more than he should. Well, hopefully he won't be able to after this, since they should be in different, like, worlds, dimensions, or time zones. Speaking of different worlds, dimensions, and time zones, Dark Avengers 184. We've got the Dark Avengers off in another dimension and stuff. It's a cool one, and I like it, but between the FF having just left planet, the Dark Avengers having just left planet, Cap having left the planet, Thor in space, it seems like, you know, at one point DC was doing a bunch of stories where the world without Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, you know, 52 and Trinity and stuff like that, as if they were the problems. And now Marvel seems to be scattering their heroes to the winds, or the four quadrants of the galaxy, or what have you, as if having them all in New York was part of the problem. And I disagree with that assessment, but it seems like they're trying to do that, which is going to make the, you know, inevitable, you know, crossover between everything and some major event going to be really awkward. But they'll do it nonetheless, I bet. Demon Knights number 15. I believe this is the final issue from Paul Cornell. Not positive on that. What really I thought was the highlight of that, or the noteworthy point, I should say, not the highlight, but the noteworthy point, is at the end it says, and next issue, 30 years later. So they're going to put some distance between what they've done and what they're about to do.
I think that's not a bad idea, since it is set so far in the past, you know, to kind of not have a more direct kind of sequeling, you know, or just continuation of the story. It's just giving the new writer just a little bit of distance there.
I would agree with that if it were like 5 years, maybe even 10, 30. For some of these characters, that's a bit of time. For others, not at all.
I will say, yeah, you know, for The Shining Knight and Exoristos, if I'm pronouncing, you know, it's like who appear, maybe she's, or though no, she could be an Amazon and is.
She is an Amazon. But
I mean, I don't know if they're playing the Amazons as kind of like immortal back at those, you know, or long lived or something. But, you know, Vandal Savage and Xanadu and the Demon.
Obviously not a big
obviously
deal.
Obviously, it's not a problem for them to be, you know, X number of years later.
But the guy who's essentially the Batman analog in that team.
Yeah, yeah.
That 30 years is a big deal to him. He'll age a little.
Yeah.
So.
That's true. I'll be interested to see how they play it, and maybe some new characters come in.
Now, are you reading Superboy?
I am not. I dropped Superboy when they started doing a lot of the Fairchild kind of stuff with it.
Superboy had one of those, you've got to be kidding me, I'm not seeing what I think I'm seeing kind of scenes. This is part of the Hell on Earth crossover. Superboy has been injured. Superman takes him to the fortress. And, you know, he's realizing his DNA is unraveling. We must save him. How do we do this? And in an issue of Action Comics, Superman had gotten his arm, battle armor, Kryptonian battle armor, and it had healed him, saved him, whatever. I was thinking, well, maybe it can do the same for the clone. So we get this digital effect where it kind of comes off him into the S shield, which he then places on Superboy. So we get some awkward shadows in a few places as that's happening, and of course, this is all Soup's been wearing for quite some time. He even comments as such. And even further, he had to comment at one point, "Sorry, I darted off to go get some clothes." But this whole concept of you know, Superman standing buck naked, you know, while giving his clothes to Superboy, just a little odd. There's that one site that recaps all the Superman, you know, shenanigans he pulled against, like, Lois Lane and stuff that made him seem like rather a bit of a jerk or whatever. Some of that, it's like, well, that was the 50s, that was the 60s, different time, different era. This just came out. I don't know, it just, again, some of the stuff they're putting in a teen book, I don't know, seems a little, I mean, that one wasn't gratuitous or anything like that, thankfully, but.
Talk a little bit about the Hell on Earth, because I pretty much jumped off all the Superman books. Superman, Supergirl. I mean, I dropped Superboy a while ago,
mm-hmm.
but when Hell on Earth started, I dropped Superman and Supergirl also. I mean, I'm still getting Action, but it's not involved in that. So
right.
What's your assessment of Hell on Earth?
The character is Kryptonian and plays mind games big time. So he's trying to turn Supergirl against Superman, obviously has no respect for a Kryptonian clone, because they're just, you know, inherently evil, of course. Which is why he damaged Superboy the way he did. They're trying to have, you know, a Superman-class threat for the Superman family. And, you know, I get that, I understand that, but some of the stuff that's going on, particularly in Action Comics under Grant Morrison, the power level you need to have for that is just outrageous. This guy is so fast, Superman can't even see him move. Just poof, he's gone. You know, he's able to convince Supergirl that he is Superman. You know, so it's almost like he's got Kryptonian powers, classic Martian powers, and, you know, amped up another couple of levels or whatever. So some of that's a little ridiculous. Overall, it's not a bad crossover storyline. It's really the first time Superman, Superboy, and Supergirl are all interacting in one story. But right now, I think Superboy's getting a little overexposed in so much as he's in this, he's in his own title, he's in Teen Titans, he's in Ravagers. I think there was somewhere else we might have seen him this week or recently. But, you know, he's just all over the place. And then again, this whole bit with the armor and stuff, because once Superboy's in the armor, he looks pretty much just like Superman. I mean, the facial features are not that different that I think if you were to fly through Metropolis, people would just, well, it's Superman, of course. He's in the armor. And, of course, Superman needing armor, I find a little ridiculous, but okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's one that, oh, wow, you're good to have avoided it, but, you know, I can understand why you did.
I just, it was one of these ones where it just didn't appear particularly appealing to me.
Yeah, I can understand that. Have you read the latest issue of Walking Dead?
Yes, I have.
All right. My take on this, which I suspect will be very different than yours, this issue, remember back when the governor tortured Michonne back around issue 48-ish?
Yes, I do.
Okay. This reminded me of that issue. It's a very different issue, different characters involved, no major physical torture involved, but there's some psychological torture, there's some grossness. There are things like that where, from a thematic storytelling point of view, I don't want to say that Kirkman's repeating himself, but to me, this is another one of those. This issue, again, had very strong, I thought, thematic parallels to that issue. They're trying to show that this one guy is really a bad guy. You know, let's kind of, you know, have him, you know, manipulate slash psychologically, you know, torture or whatever this one other character. And I'm almost expecting that other character to then brutally murder the big bad in pretty short order. But that's just my take on it.
I think they're certainly setting up Negan as, you know, this guy, like just this, you know,
Governor 2.0,
you know, governor kind of psycho kind of guy. And there's some interesting aspects to, you know, kind of the mind games and control aspects that, you know, how he's specifically controlling and running and manipulating these characters. You know, I found it to be kind of interesting. I am intrigued by mostly, you know, I read this and it's like, man, how's Kirkman going to get Carl out of this one? You know, kind of that's the general thing. It's like, I am, you know, in that respect, it works really well because I'm very interested to keep reading this to see what happens next.
It would not surprise me, and since you mentioned it was Carl, the kid, it would not surprise me if Carl ends up killing Negan and taking over the town just de facto, because, I mean, everyone who was terrified of Negan would be petrified of a kid Carl's age having just, you know, blown him away or what have you. He would then send the contingent down to the town where his father and the rest of the people we've been following are, and invite them to go meet the new leader. And it could be a very interesting dynamic between, you know, Carl and his father, Rick. That's one way they could go. But what's fun with Kirkman is you can see kind of the obvious place he would go. There's often the 180 degrees opposite from that. And, you know, he it's almost like he flips a coin to decide where to go. And every once in a while goes in a completely unexpected third direction.
Right. And that's where I find it interesting because, you know, he typically does not do the obvious thing. So I'm just like, how is he going to resolve this thing?
But to me, this was a clear case of one of those issues where he is just blatantly manipulating the readers and setting them up for something. You know, and that's I think one of Kirkman's both greatest strengths and greatest weaknesses. Because again, I thought it was a very, you know, moving, you know, issue. It had a lot of power to it. But again, as I was reading it, I couldn't help but draw very clear parallels to the governor and Michonne and that stuff back then, which I thought actually that one issue back then, I thought was a both a pivotal issue and a high watermark in terms of just the quality. I thought it was incredibly gross and gory or whatever. And aspects of this, I felt the same way. But it was one of those that Kirkman really knows how to connect to readers on a very emotional, almost visceral level, and move the story along effectively and then set people up for, you know, the next major twist, turn, whatever. I mean, I'm hoping this, you know, is going to be, at least from my perspective, a bit of a turning point for the series and kind of kick it back into a high gear, because I think between the governor stuff and this stuff, he's been doing okay. But I thought some of what he did with the governor stuff, the prison, there are a few places early on where it's just every... He was, I think, on a much more strong creative level earlier than he has been over the last few years. And he's had, you know, other distractions, the TV show, being publisher at Image, Skybound, whatever, that maybe he's now kind of metabolized that into his schedule and is ready to kind of kick this into a higher, you know, more impressive gear. Mm-hmm. Which it's a wildly successful comic as is. So even though my, you know, assessment of it has cooled a bit, most people's hasn't. So if he could really amp it up, I mean, we could easily see this be a top 10 comic book on the sales charts every month. And I would frankly love to see that happen. Cause it would be a bit of a wake up call to Marvel, DC, and pretty much everyone else out there that a book that started around the 6,000 unit level could, you know, not only sustain for over 100 issues, but do that, grow its audience, and become a solid top seller.
No, I absolutely agree with you on that. And I think he keeps doing, you know, enough unexpected and interesting twists and turns in the storyline that it's just keeps interesting. I mean, it's no longer, you know, for a while there, it was my absolute number one go-to book when I, you know, pulled my box open, and it has fallen a bit from there, but it's still easily top five, top 10 material for me. I think a lot of the Valiant stuff, which we got a couple of Valiant issues in the shipment too. Those books are now my de facto, you know, first go-to books. And I continue to be impressed with how much I'm liking Valiant across the board. You know, every single issue that they put out, you know, it's just, I don't like them all equally, but all of them are so well done. And, you know,
I would agree with that. The Valiant is just an exceptional publisher these days. They came not out of nowhere, of course, but from zero titles up to the five they've got now. And the quality level is very impressive. The art level, the story level, I mean, everything. If people aren't checking them out, they really should be.
Yeah, it's, you know, Archer and Armstrong came out this week. Really good. Bloodshot, really good. Now, question, did you read both those yet?
Yes.
So at the end of Bloodshot, they kind of leave it off, like, you know, at a point, but then the next issue blurb implies that it's going to not continue the story from that point. At least it did to me.
Let me pull that one out and open it up real quick. I thought this was leading into the crossover, and it was looking like this kid might have been sending Bloodshot after Harbinger. I'm not quite sure, though. In other words, I don't think they're just going to not pick up on this on the next issue.
Right.
But I think this is the kids from the Project Rising Sun stuff that we're hearing about in the XO Bloodshot, or not the XO, the Bloodshot Harbinger crossover stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I have complete faith that, you know, whatever they do, I'll enjoy. I mean, so far, I have, you know, after that first one that I was a little rocky, and I still feel on that first issue of XO that the pacing could have been done a little differently, but they really recovered from that.
Yeah.
You know, I have no complaints about any of the books that I'm reading from them. They are just knocking it out of the park. And, you know, my favorites of them shifts every couple of months. Archer and Armstrong was my absolute number one favorite, but now it's Harbinger, especially after the last issue, I think, with Chris. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was the issue before the current issue. I forget, but it was like number six. Is that the current issue?
I think so.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just like, wow. You know, that book is just in high gear for me, which actually kind of brings me back, because Harbinger was my favorite of the, you know, original Valiant series as well. So,
I guess for me, Bloodshot and Archer and Armstrong are the top tier. The next two would be Harbinger and Exo, and then Shadow Man below that. But, I mean, they're all really solid stuff. They're doing, again, great work there, and people really ought to check that publisher out if they're not.
Yeah, fabulous, fabulous stuff. I just can't say enough good things about them. They're just like, you know, wow.
Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That pretty much does it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss JSA The Liberty Files, The Whistling Skull, number one from Marvel, Thor, God of Thunder, number three from Marvel, and Executive Assistant Assassins, number six from Aspen.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.